This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
The Mine Wars, the bitter battle fought by a people made of steel.
We're going to talk to Randall McLowry, producer and director, who goes inside the coal miners' bitter battle for dignity at the dawn of the 20th century with the Mine Wars, the struggle over the material that fueled America, which led to the largest armed insurrection since the Civil War and turned parts of West Virginia into a bloody war zone. At the dawn of the 20th century, coal was the fuel that powered the nation, yet few Americans thought much about the men who blasted the black rock from underground and hauled it to the surface.
The Mine Wars tells the overlooked story of the miners in the mountains of southern West Virginia, Native mountaineers, African-American migrants, and European immigrants who came together in a protracted struggle for their right.
Let's first listen to this introductory segment to this new PBS documentary, The Mine War.
In most cultures where there are coal miners, middle-class people and above think they're animals, literally, and treat them that way, and they know that. So what they do is reverse that matter, and they take pride in the fact that they can actually survive in such a place. And it makes them hard, and they stand on their own, and they don't care what the public thinks.
Strangers rarely found their way into the coal camps of southern West Virginia. So when a matronly older woman walked into a camp one fall morning in 1901, the local storekeeper was curious. He invited her in and asked her who she was and what was her business in town. The answer appeared to unnerve him. She was the notorious Mother Jones, there to convince the coal miners in the area to join her union, the United Mine Workers of America, the UMW.
Whenever somebody came down, like Mother Jones, to talk to the people there about, you know, the union, they'd be run out of town by men with shotguns.
Southern West Virginia was an industrial police state, more or less. The operators or owners did not want anyone who had union sympathies or was interested in bringing the union into their camps to be there.
The president of the UMW had apologized in advance for sending Jones on this mission. Some union officials thought it was a lost cause. While men in the northern coal fields had scratched and clawed to bring their union into being over the previous 10 years, miners in southern West Virginia had been beaten down by the mine owners, whose power in the state was virtually unchecked. Mother Jones quickly found out what workers were up against. Private guards hired by the coal operators waved guns in her face and threatened to kill anyone who passed out handbills advertising a meeting about the union. But Jones insisted she could succeed where nobody else had.
West Virginia might be this backwater place to most people, but for her, she sees it as a place of resistance and a place that she wants to be part of a fight. Whenever there was a struggle, Mother Jones was there. She said, "I have no home except where there is struggle."
Mary Harris Jones had been driven from her native Ireland by the potato famine when she was a teenager, then watched her husband and four children die during a yellow fever epidemic just after the Civil War. After she lost her dressmaking business in the Great Chicago Fire, she remade herself as the nation's most unlikely labor organizer. All through that winter and into the spring thaw, the 65-year-old Jones kept up what she called weary tramps through the dead of night, selling West Virginia miners on the idea of union.
The basic impetus behind the union movement was the idea that by providing some sort of collective way for workers to bargain, to present their grievances, the unions could give workers strength, could sort of muster the strength of individuals and give them a way of standing up against these enormous corporations that were becoming ever more powerful.
Jones challenged West Virginians to stop acting like cringing serfs and to commit to the UMW. She was loud, she was profane, she was demanding.
The miners loved it. They loved seeing this little old lady just out there kicking butt, basically, and cussing and carrying on. She was saying that they had something to stand up for and to fight back.
She was speaking in social revolutionary terms. These towns are ours. These mines are ours. You really didn't deserve to own these mines. That's what she would say. She does communicate a kind of motherly love that says, why are you letting yourself be abused? Aren't you better than this?
This whole place is stirred up, Jones reported to UMW headquarters. 6 months ago, these men were afraid to look at me. Today, they are realizing they are men and have some rights on this earth. Mother Jones could not have known it that spring, but she had sparked a fight that would escalate over the next 20 years from an unremarkable skirmish between capital and labor to the largest armed insurrection since the Civil War. Mother Jones, her followers, and her antagonists would turn the coal fields of southern West Virginia into a blood-soaked war zone, where basic constitutional rights and freedoms were violently contested.
The story of the West Virginia Mine Wars is a profoundly American story of people's belief in the principles of the Founding Fathers. What these people were fighting for was the rights that they thought their government had guaranteed them and had been denied them.
The right to free assembly, the right to free speech, and the idea that just because you worked for someone shouldn't mean that that person had a kind of tyrannical control over you, but that you, as a worker, had certain democratic rights as well.
And we do welcome Randall McLowery, producer and director of The Mine Wars. And I have to say, from the very moment the film opens with the grainy black and white portraits of the miners with their overalls, everybody wore overalls, I was thinking to myself, and maybe this is unfair, but I thought to myself, you know, we look at the picture endlessly of the Mona Lisa and make, oh, it's enigmatic and all kinds of marvels at it. Well, I've never quite thought that about the portrait, but when I looked at the portrait of the faces of these miners and their children and the women who were often on the picket lines during strikes, etc. They are some of the most beautiful, some of the most pointed and poignant portraits I have ever seen. And I think that the film is just staggeringly beautiful in its depiction of the blood, sweat, and tears of the working people. And so I really commend you for the visuals aside from the story, which is deep and rich and profound. So I loved The Mine Wars.
Well, thank you. I'm thrilled to hear that. I totally agree with you in terms of the beauty and the dignity and that these images reflect of these people. And these people took great pride in their work. I don't know that that's often associated with coal mining. These men that were really very hidden, both in the fact that they were underground doing their work, but, you know, these are the men that really provided the fuel, as you indicated in the beginning, that fueled America at that time. And they really didn't reap the fruits of their labor, but yet they lived and worked a very dignified and a very proud life, and they lived and they worked in great danger. And I think that's, you know, you do hear about, you know, recently obviously the mining accidents that do happen still today, but, you know, women didn't know every day if their husbands would be coming home, and yet they still, you know, really took, as I said, you know, an immense amount of pride in their work. And I feel that these photographs and this imagery of their lives, which I am so thrilled were so well documented, you know, early in the 20th century, provided a real visual tapestry and mosaic that we could present. And what I also find, you know, wonderful in these faces is that it is a very diverse group of faces that you see.
And tell us more about what you mean by diverse group of faces and also the conditions that they labored under in this beautiful environment.
Or well, not so beautiful environment, well, as the case may
well,
be.
Well, above ground, anyway.
Above ground.
Well, in terms of the diversity, this was a very, you know, for the time, it was a very diverse group of people that were brought together to labor in the coal mines. It was the coal fields that we focus on are the coal fields of southern West Virginia, which were very inaccessible, and they were really only opened up when the railroads came through, and they had been populated by families that lived off the land, and when the coal industry came through, there really was a great upheaval to their existence, and you know, many of them lost their land to outside investors, and so you had a people that were, to a great degree, forced to exist in this kind of rural industrial environment, and many of them did become coal miners. So you had that group of native West Virginians that were, you know, going into the mines. And then you had also individuals that were being recruited from both the South, so you had African-American, often sharecroppers, that were being recruited to work in the coal fields. And some of them also were actually, you know, moving up there of their own accord because they actually had a greater, they actually had a sort of a more egalitarian existence there because they were able to be paid a more equal, for their work they were paid an equal pay. So a miner who was white and a miner who was black doing the same job would get the same pay, which was very unusual at that time. And then you had immigrants from Europe, primarily Eastern Europe and Italy and so on, that were being recruited off of the wharves and up in along New England and New York. And so you had this real diverse mixture of individuals that are populating this very rural environment, living in a very forced situation. So they lived in coal towns that were created by the coal operators. They weren't unlike other coal areas in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Illinois, there really wasn't any infrastructure for the miners to live. So the coal operators had to create these artificial towns, in essence, which they controlled. And so you had a, you know, this great coming together of different individuals, and there were certainly those issues of prejudice and so on that existed at that time in the country, but there was also, I think partly due to what you talk about, what you asked about in terms of the conditions they lived under, you know, these dangerous conditions sort of forced them in some ways to unite. Underground, you had to depend on the person next to you, and it didn't matter whether you were white, black, Italian, and they often talked about that, you know, when they came out of the coal mines, everybody was covered in coal dust, and you couldn't distinguish one ethnicity or racial group from another. And for the time period, I think it was a sort of a social solidarity that it was unique in the coal fields of southern West Virginia, and that then translated into when they actually were starting to fight for their rights, that they also found this other commonality. You know, they had basically the coal operators that were their opposition that they were uniting against.
I was tremendously impressed. I knew that there were people of African ancestry that were miners during that period of time, but I had never seen the kind of footage that showed how many and the significance of the African miners. And the fact of the way in which these company towns and the policing apparatus, the apparatus of the state that was very often called into play to support the private security forces of the mine owners to keep people in check, I just had never seen before and learned so much of the manipulation, the way they tried to keep labor divided along racial lines. And I have to say that the term wage slavery really came to mind to me with the incredibly important depiction, again, of the role of these state towns, which were really synonymous and intertwined with the mine owners who ran the post offices, who really controlled in many instances the again the social control mechanisms. It's fabulous. And the fact that a good deal of the story is told by the miners and the descendants of miners is really gratifying and just adds another kind of jolt of reality and significance to this, including great scholars like Joe William Trotter Jr., the black historian, had written great works on coal and class and color, mm-hmm. blacks in southern West Virginia. So really the story is told with such reality, such pathos, and such good politics, understanding the contribution of the working class and what they fought for their dignity and mm-hmm. for democracy.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I feel very fortunate that we're able to, you know, get such an expert and passionate group of individuals to be speaking. And many of these scholars did have their own ties to West Virginia and coal mining, which I think informed their own explorations in academia, and I think also then added to, you know, the passion that they brought to telling of the story, and then also connecting with individuals that had been miners and had grown up in the area or grown up in a coal town. And so they had that connection to that experience through their own family. And they also had the connection to the land, which I think is an important part of West Virginia as well. You know, there is a real sort of, in the sense of the community that was established. And, you know, I think Denise Giardina, who is a novelist, a wonderful writer, who wrote a beautiful book about the mine world called Storming Heaven. And she captures, I think, that wonderfully in terms of sort of the emotional connection that many, many people that grew up in these communities have to them. And while there is a lot of, it was not an easy life, and certainly, you know, at those times when they did live in, you know, to a great degree, very much of an industrial police state, that there was forging of ties that I think are very long-lasting. And I think you there are many, many people you came across in making this film that were, you know, very grateful that we were telling their story. And that's very satisfying as a filmmaker to be able to be connecting to individuals on that level.
You know, we don't have too much more time for this segment, but let's cut to the most dramatic part of the film, which is the latter part of the film having to do with the situation in southern West Virginia, where they try to organize and get into almost an insurrection. And it'll be a real challenge to summarize that in about 3 or 4 minutes.
But and no, by the way,
no, you can do it.
I can't even believe you got that footage, the Battle of Blair Mountain. It was just staggering. It's some of the most dramatic film footage I've ever seen of the struggles of the working class for that dignity, for the right to live and benefit from the work that they create. So do tell us about that.
Well, I'll try my best in a very short period of time, but it's basically the explosion of several decades of fighting against this almost tyrannical regime that the coal operators held over southern West Virginia, and in some ways, you know, it was controlled by terror, and the thing that sparked it was the killing of Sid Hatfield, who was the chief of police in Matewan, who had been part of an event called the Matewan Massacre, which I won't go into, but his killing on the courthouse steps in broad daylight kind of was the spark that kind of pushed them over the edge. At that time in Matewan and in Mingo County, they were basically under martial law as they were trying to strike and to unionize down there, and the pushback from the state and the coal operators was basically to militarize that area. And the miners basically decided that, you know, the only way they could secure their rights was, as one miner said, with a high-powered rifle. And they, you know, basically they massed around near Charleston, and they were going to march from there south to Domingo County to free miners that had been unlawfully imprisoned, and they were armed, and they were going to, you know, they weren't going to be stopped. And then put in their way was Don Chaffin, the sheriff of Logan County, which was in between where they were in Mingo County, who basically was in, you know, in the payroll of the coal companies, and along with a force of 30,000, you know, 3,000 heavily fortified deputies and volunteers, these two, you know, armies, which in some ways you can say were civilian armies in a certain way, clashed, and there was basically a ferocious three-day battle that happened. It wasn't stopped until the federal government sent in the army to put down the violence. And the miners put down their guns, and they hoped that things would change, but in fact they didn't. Many of them were tried for treason. They were acquitted, but there were numerous of them that were convicted of other charges. And basically, you know, they in essence they lost that battle. They didn't get what they wanted, but you know, it took another almost full decade until the 1933 with the New Deal, and
we're going to have to leave it at the New Deal.
Okay, so
I think you've whetted people's appetite.
But you've more than that. Part of the American experience on PBS. It is searing. It is our story, the story of the working class in its most militant struggle, valiant, heroic for dignity, for the ability to live, and the terrible betrayals of the state. But, yes, we did get the New Deal, so you'll find out about that, too. Randall McLowry, you did a phenomenal job, and I enjoyed every moment, and we can watch the film many times, The Mine Wars. Randall McLowry, producer, director, thanks for joining us, and thanks for your stellar work.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
And The Mine Wars can be viewed online at PBS's American Experience website, and the DVD can be purchased from PBS. Now more segments from The Mine Wars.
Coal Town really is almost an instruction ground for exploitation. Mine workers, they can see it very directly, and their families see it very directly. They take all the risks, they bring out that coal, and it's producing wealth for people who don't live there.
The coal towns were almost always unincorporated. There were no elected officials, no independent police forces. Owners hired private detective agencies to watch over their workforce. Company towns were also untethered from the free market competition owners usually champion. Operators often paid workers in company currency, called scrip. They forced mining families to shop exclusively at the company store, which they stocked with food, fuel, and clothing, even the tools and blasting powder required on the job. They set the prices of all those goods to assure a profit, a hedge against operating losses in the mines themselves.
They paid you with their money. You bought your food off of them, unless you wanted to take a dollar scrip and sell it for 75 cents government money and lose a fourth of your wages. They was oppressed all the time.
If they give the miners a raise, then they're going to raise the rent and raise everything, the cost of food in the company store and raise the clothing and everything. So you actually, you're right back where you started from.
When a miner went to pick up his check, they had what was called a checkoff list. Your house belongs to the company, we check that much off. You bought your groceries here this month at the company store, we check that off. By the time they finished the check off, there was very little left.
The only options that you have once you're trapped in that system is to keep your head down and do what you're told, or stand up and fight.
The southern West Virginia coal fields were really the up-and-coming coal fields. They had tremendous demand for new miners because the industry was expanding so much. The only way to really bring more coal out of the ground was to put more mine workers underground. And the coal companies in southern West Virginia are bringing African American miners up from the south and bringing people in from southern and eastern Europe.
My father came here from Calabria, Italy, with his brother Antonio. His name was Fortunato Battaglia. Coal company agents would come up to him, he said, and say, "Lavoro a casa." In other words, "We can give you a job and a home." And they had nothing to lose.
My family decided to come from South Carolina to the coal fields of West Virginia for economic reasons and cultural reasons. My parents were sharecroppers, and the life of sharecroppers wasn't the best life. The South wasn't very free where black people were concerned.
In West Virginia, African Americans entered a class and racially stratified society. But compared to the South and compared to the North, West Virginia was a place in which they got a more equitable footing. There were more black miners in West Virginia than anywhere else in the nation. And black workers in this environment gained access to a system that proclaimed equal pay for the same work.
There was a lot of conflict among the different groups of coal miners because they didn't know each other, and so you had a great deal of prejudice. And the companies reinforced that by building coal camps so that you had a section for black miners, had a section for Eastern European miners, and there was a section for Native Appalachian miners. And that was done on purpose. The coal operators felt that that diversity would keep unionization at bay.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.